On Sunday afternoon, out after all the wonderful, joyful celebrations around Lisa and Reed Carlson's ordinations, I received a phone call and learned that my grandma, Dolores, had died. If I have to admit it, she was my favorite grandma. She was my last living grandparent, and just a wonderful, wonderful woman, incredibly vivacious and generous, elegant, always the life of the party. But she had also had dementia for the last 15 years, so it made for a very complicated grief. Because for those of us who loved her, in a way, the Dolores we knew had been dead for 15 years. We can find suffering everywhere, and we don't have to look hard for it. I don't know about you, but I am still mourning the death of Clementa Pinckney and the members of AME, Emanuel, and Charleston who were killed. And I opened the paper yesterday to see that there were terrorist attacks all over the world. And so there is suffering that is going on all around us. All of our scriptures today, but one, actually talk about suffering. People who are suffering, or the writer of Lamentations is one who has come through incredible suffering. And even the reading from 2 Corinthians, which Devin read a moment ago, Paul is suffering. He is trying to raise money for the very poor members of the Jerusalem church who are suspicious of him. And he's trying to raise that money from the Christians in Corinth who don't like him. So I know he is suffering too. I think when we suffer, when we face discouragement, defeat, a string of defeats, illness, death, it is natural to ask the question, where is God? Where is God in this suffering? In our gospel lesson, we are introduced to the leader of a synagogue named Jairus, and he has come to Jesus. He is a very respectable man, a learned man, probably a wealthy man, esteemed in the community. And he comes down and falls before Jesus and pleads with him to come and lay hands on his daughter who is dying. And I think all of us, the thought of a child being ill or dying is more than most of us can bear and one of our greatest fears. We're also introduced to a woman who has had a hemorrhage for 12 years. I can't even imagine. And she has spent everything that she has had, everything she had in her desire to get well. And there has been no cure. In fact, she is worse. And now she is poor from paying all those medical bills. She is also desperate. These two dramatic encounters with Jesus take place at the intersection of life and death. And I know many of you have been there. In these encounters, Jesus is crossing religious, social, and emotional boundaries. Jesus is willing to enter others' pain and suffering. He is ending up touching two women, one willingly, one who touches him, actually. And in light of his religious beliefs, he becomes unclean by touching a dead body as well as a woman who is hemorrhaging. But he is willing to do that. And these two women are invisible to their society. The little girl is actually 12, which was marrying age in her culture. And she is well-to-do, but the other woman is older and poor. So we have a boundary between childhood and adulthood here, and a little girl with the potential to give life. Jesus meets the girl and the woman and their loved ones in the space between death and life. This is a liminal space and a liminal time. And Jesus, in these situations, as in so many others, inserts himself into places where life is unexplainable, very hard to put into words, in moments or movements beyond our power and comprehension. Now, if you go into your worship bulletin and look at that reading from the third chapter of Lamentations that Jonas read, you probably want to know, if you don't already, that this writer, this poet, wrote in the context of the siege and destruction of Jerusalem, where everything looked like it was coming to an end. The world was imploding for this writer. And while the passage that you heard Jonas read a moment ago sounded very hopeful and encouraging, if you go back to the early verses of chapter 3, you hear a lament. For example, I am one who has seen affliction under the rod of God's wrath. He has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Against me alone turns his hand, again and again all day long. And the verses right before our reading, the thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. And then the passage that you heard a moment ago. And this passage is not only hopeful, in which the poet is clinging to God's promises, God's faithfulness, but it's also a Jewish rhetorical strategy that appears elsewhere in the Hebrew scriptures, in which the poet, or we've seen others like Abraham, try to remind God of God's faithfulness in the hopes of changing God's mind. The poet here reminds God of God's own integrity and character in the hope of getting what he wants. Do you remember Abraham's words to, on behalf of Sodom, shall not the judge of the earth do what is just? So, hey, God, remember who you are, remember your character, and do what I want. One scholar of Lamentations wrote that the third chapter is a mixture of hope and despair. And it ends in a plea to God, which leaves us balanced on a knife edge between these two. When we experience suffering and loss, and perhaps loss upon loss, it is natural to ask, where is God? And even, I've heard many people ask, and I've asked it myself, has God abandoned me? When we have a series of difficult events in our lives, or maybe are at a certain life stage where we are going through many different losses, we can become fearful, anxious, and feel out of control, wondering what is coming next. Even though the hemorrhaging woman touched Jesus in a large crowd, he was, according to the gospel, immediately aware that power had gone forth from him. He asked, who touched my clothes? And the disciples just, I can imagine the look on their face. What? You are surrounded by a large crowd. How can you say, who touched me? Lots of people are touching you, Jesus. You're in this mosh pit here of all these people wanting something from you. But Jesus knew that power had left him, and that the power that went to the hemorrhaging woman was the power of life in the face of disease and despair. That power is God's power of life and love. It is actively moving in and through our world and our lives, bringing sustenance, hope, and healing to those who face suffering, death, discouragement, and seemingly insurmountable obstacles. We recently had a glimpse of Jesus' life and love in the midst of suffering and death, in the ability of the members of AME Emmanuel in Charleston to offer forgiveness to the man who killed their son, their mother, their grandmother, their grandfather. When Nadine Collier, daughter of 70-year-old Ethel Lance, turned to a screen that projected the face of Dylan Roof and said, "You took something very precious away from me. I will never talk to her again." See if I can get through this. "I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you, and God have mercy on your soul." Nadine Collier is a bigger woman than me. When she said these words, these unbelievable words, she testified to the power of God's redemptive love in the midst of violence, tragedy, and sorrow, and confirmed what the biblical story tells us repeatedly: love wins. Nadine Collier's hope, in the midst of pain more intense than I think most of us can imagine, came from the knowledge that Dylan Roof's act of violence was not ultimate. Only God is ultimate, and God's love and vision for life will triumph over everything and everyone opposed to reconciliation, healing, and abundant life for all. We are part of an incredible story, the story where love wins, a story of a God who never stopped being faithful to the people and earth God created so lovingly, even when they killed one another, ignored God, and destroyed the earth. A story of a God who sent his son, his beloved son, to be with us in great vulnerability. The story of a Jesus who gave his life so that we might live. The story of God's ultimate healing and reconciliation of all things and all people. A kingdom or reign comprised of people from every tribe, every nation, every background, living together peacefully in reconciled diversity. I've heard some say that Nadine Collier forgave too soon. But I think that her faith, developed over the years from hearing the story of God and God's love for the world, studying and living the biblical story, practicing the biblical story, enabled to express an intention of forgiveness in the midst of her numbness and unspeakable grief. What does this mean for us as we experience the ambiguities of life, or walk with others who are going through the ambiguities of life? Suffering, death, racism, violence, and homophobia. Jesus' words to the hemorrhaging woman, "Do not fear, only believe," are better translated, and I like the translation of James Boyce over at Luther Seminary: "Stop being afraid and go on living by faith. Stop being afraid. Stop being afraid. And go on living by faith. Let us continue to live by faith, whatever we face, knowing that God's power of life and love are active and at work in our lives and in our world, and that ultimately love wins. Amen.